Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, where this time we're exploring the flickers and flourishes that make Irish music sound special with composer Dave Flynn. Later on, it's the sound of a bell that can't be heard that inspires a new piece from Tygo Sullivan, and we'll meet the soprano who's reactivating the repertoire of one of the stars of a good night out in 1750s Ireland. The posh bit, obviously. But first, why does Irish trad sound like it does? How do you know it when you hear it? Some of the answers to these questions with composer and guitarist Dave Flynn. Flynn's own compositions frequently look at areas where trad and concert music cross over, or at least bump into each other in the pub. As part of these explorations, he's used his guitar to delve deeply into aspects of Irish trad, such as tuning and ornamentation, techniques that can be hard, maybe even impossible to notate, but whose specificities tell us a great deal about what Irish music is. Dave Flynn came to Culturefile Towers recently with two guitars and some thoughts.
So this is somebody attempting to play Irish music.
I describe it as a classical guitarist who has an arrangement of the very basic part of an Irish melody, without really having any training or understanding of Irish traditional music.
What are you hearing there?
Very well played from a classical guitar perspective. There's no doubting they're a very good classical guitarist, but basically what you're hearing there is, if you open up a book of Irish tunes, slight and kind of harmonic embellishments on that, but basically the way they're playing the tune is not related to how a master traditional Irish musician would play the tune. It's very much playing a skeleton that's just in the book. There's none of the things, characteristic things that make a tune Irish, so to say.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there isn't that kind of swing, that kind of drive that you kind of get in the best of Irish.
Yeah, there's definitely not a swing to it. And the rhythm, there's no ornamentation, no variation in terms of melodic variation. It's an important part of traditional Irish music. Also, the tone of the playing is very much a classical tone, and it's like if you hear an Irish fiddle player and a classical violinist, they're a completely different sound. And the Irish, there's various types of sounds in Irish music and in classical music, but the fiddle sound tends to be quite different to the classical violin sound. So the same could be applied to the guitar to get a more Irishy kind of sound.
There's the nub of it. What is an Irishy sound like? What does Irish music, and I guess we're talking about Irish traditional music, sound like?
Well, Irish music is such a broad school, and it's not necessarily traditional Irish music. There's all sorts of, there's Irish jazz, Irish classical, everything. But if we're talking specifically about traditional Irish music, within that there's different traditions. You have the singing tradition, Seanós singing. You have the harp tradition, Celtic harp kind of sounds. And then there's fiddle music, pipe music, concertina music, flute, whistle, but broadly they're kind of thought of as two kind of different things. There's the dance music and the slow music, the airs. What is that? I suppose there's various different sounds and techniques and instrumentations have developed over the years around certain melodies and melodic forms that are common to Ireland, not always originating in Ireland, but there's a certain way of articulating and playing the music that makes it sound. For a musician who's classically trained, if they're looking at a sheet music, that it either will have no ornamentation written into it, or the ornamentation that's written in will confuse them because they're used to playing something different to what an Irish fiddle player would play. So the simplest ornamentation in Irish music is called a cut, and it looks like what classical musicians call grace notes. a classical musician playing a grace note would sound something like this. It's kind of one clear note played kind of quickly before a main note. So in that case, it's a G going to an E. Whereas a cut kind of is like, it's kind of cutting the note. You don't really hear the G. One thing to understand is the main difference in ornamentation between Irish and classical music is that the Irish ornaments tend to be mostly rhythmic, kind of percussive ornamentation. They're not melodic. There is melodic ornamentation, but most of these techniques, cuts, crans, rolls, trebles, a lot of the time it's a percussive effect. But when it's written in sheet music, it's rarely written like that. So if you put down an Irish tune in front of a classical musician and they play it, the ornamentation will just not sound like a fiddle player or a piper or something like that, you know.
Why is that? Why is it percussive?
It's just the way the sound developed. Like, some of the ornamentations come out of piping and it just kind of has, the ornaments have that kind of, it just sounds like that.
The kind of burbling, is that what you mean?
Cranning is the main kind of piping technique that sounds like that. But pipers have many different ornaments, like a whole host of them. But cranning is probably the most famed one because it's complicated and there's different ways of doing it. I mean, it's impossible to do it exactly as pipers do it on the guitar, but I do my best. And it's like combining various cuts that the ornament I heard and making that bobbly sound, like it's... sound. And I suppose a sight reading musician would see something like that in a book and it might sound like, so what here, you know, I often like to put a low note with it to get a droney kind of sound, like the pipes drone, so you get, and that comes in like rhythms, you know.
So is the fact that a lot of these little ornamentations are percussive, is that related to the kind of drive that you feel in the music often?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of this music is dance music, so it doesn't have what, you know, classical musicians call rubato, which is bending the rhythm. That really wouldn't be characteristic in playing traditional Irish dance music, because you want to keep a motor kind of rhythm going. Imagine there's someone dancing with you. One of the main ornaments that causes confusion is in Irish music we call it a roll, and notated it looks like what classical musicians would call a turn. And a turn is a, and sometimes the same symbol is used in Irish collections as well, for there's a kind of a on the side S, it looks like. So if a classical musician sees that, it's say on a D note, they will go very melodic, you know, that kind of sound. Whereas a fiddle player, a piper, they will do much quicker. It's quite hard to do on the guitar as opposed to the fiddle, but so you kind of hear a, it's you're not wanting to hear a clear, you want, it's much more rapid. So if you were to play an Irish tune, that's a classical musician sight reading it. That's a roll as I've adapted it to the guitar.
That's the version that your head just automatically starts nodding.
Yeah, exactly. It's more vigour to it and more, definitely more rhythmic.
You mentioned there that this is more difficult on a guitar than a than a fiddle. And I mean, one of the reasons is the strings on a fiddle are different from your guitar strings.
Well, there's the amount of strings. The guitar has six strings, fiddle has four. The use of a bow, you know, these ornaments, when you have a bow, they really flow, and the bow kind of continuously articulates the string. If you leave it on, like fiddle players tend to leave the bow on the string all the time, and that's a technical kind of thing for those who aren't string players, but it keeps the music flowing, whereas a lot of classical string technique involves taking the bow on and off, and that gives it less of a flow. The other thing is the tuning, like the kind of standard guitar tuning is A-A-D-G-B-E. Whereas the violin is tuned G-D-A-E. So when I'm playing melodic tunes, when I'm soloist playing Irish tunes, I like to tune it a bit like the violin. And this is unusual. I don't know anyone else who does it. But so I've adapted this tuning. Instead of the E, I have a D. Instead of the A, I have an open G, which simulates the low G of the violin. Then instead of the B of the standard tuning, I drop it to an A, which is the A of the violin of the fiddle. So I can do a lot of the same kind of techniques that a fiddle player would use, because they use the open strings of the instrument a lot to get certain sounds, and some of those ornaments. That's kind of craning on an A string. And that wouldn't be possible on standard tuning for a guitar.
The kind of techniques that you're describing to me now, are you inventing ways to write them, to transcribe them? I mean, there is a lot of work in extended technique, which I guess must overlap somewhat with this area.
Yeah, I've been doing, because I work with classical musicians a lot in compositions, I mean, I have a string quartet piece called The Craning that gets played quite a lot. It's getting played again in September by the Pirosmani Quartet, touring around Ireland for the National String Quartet Foundation series. And that The Craning, I notate various ways of playing craning within that. And I've worked quite hard to figure out how best to notate these techniques so that a sight reading classically trained musician who's never played Irish music gets something close to the sound, in, you know, and it certainly helps to have that kind of detail there.
Do you think the fellow we heard at the beginning would have benefited if he saw one of your manuscripts?
Definitely. Like I've been working at this for over 20 years, and I've worked with lots and lots of musicians, and I've kind of improved my understanding of how to notate it, how to explain it, and certainly with many of the musicians I've worked with, they really find it helpful to have that detail. Mickey Doherty, the great Donegal fiddle player, said if the collectors tried to notate everything we do, the page would be black. Mm-hmm.
And there'd be less of a sense of people carrying the music, I guess, as well.
Yeah, and you see, that's the important thing. Every good musician who plays traditional Irish music or other kinds of traditions like that, they make the tune their own, so they do their own version of it and they change it every time they play it. So it's almost impossible to notate a Irish tune. What you see in a book is just the skeleton that you put the flesh on the skeleton.
Thank you.
The Contempo Quartet there playing the final movement from Dave Flynn's The Cran, and we were talking there to the composer, and he'll be giving a musical lecture on transposing tradition, adapting fiddle, piping and harp music to guitar on Tuesday 21st of July at St. John's Church as part of the Joe Mooney Summer School, which runs 20th to the 27th of July in Drumshambo in County Leitrim. If you frequented the pleasure gardens of Ireland in the 1750s and 60s, and which of us hasn't, you'd likely be familiar with the voice of Rachel Baptiste, a black Irish soprano who regularly performed pop arias by Handel, Purcell and others for the merry crowds. All the same, reports of her concerts are sparse, even if one newspaper notice calls her Ireland's black siren. But this year, the Irish Baroque Orchestra and its director, Peter Whelan, who've made a specialty of excavating music played in Ireland in the period, are recreating a Rachel Baptiste performance, first on CD and later this month as part of this summer's Dublin Handel Fest. Standing in for Rachel Baptiste for the project is Glasgow-born soprano Rachel Redmond, who spoke to Culturefile's Niamh Daly about Rachel Baptiste and about her own journey into music.
I grew up listening to a lot of music. Both my parents would play music all the time. We had a huge record collection. I guess it wasn't like unusual for me to hear music, but I didn't realise that that was a job that people could do. Rachel Redmond. I'm a soprano and I'm based just outside of Paris, but I grew up in Glasgow with Irish and Tanzanian parents. I think I've been singing as long as I and my parents could remember. Apparently I just used to go around the supermarket singing and pushing the trolley, and when I was 7 years old I auditioned for the Royal Scottish National Orchestra Junior Chorus. They came round the schools in the area looking for children to sing in their children's choir to do things like the St. Matthew Passion and all the things that need young voices. And that was when I started. On my 8th birthday, I started rehearsing with them. And then I think I saw in a programme of one of the concerts that we were singing at with that orchestra that there was a music school that you could go to, and I thought that sounded like a great idea. And yeah, when I found out that you could actually be a singer for a job, I was like, oh yeah, definitely want to do that. My dad wasn't really impressed because he wanted me to come and work with him as an accountant, but somehow that didn't happen. Rachel Baptiste was a black singer who was performing in Ireland around the 1750s. There's not that much written about her personal life. Like, there's a bit written about who she married. She wore a yellow dress, apparently, to all her concerts. She was pretty famous at the time, and as you can imagine, I mean, even now there are a huge, huge amount of black opera and classical singers, and at the time, I expect it was just completely shocking for the audiences to see that. So she was singing sort of a lot of the same repertoire as I sing now, and it's really interesting to sort of think back to what her experience would have been like at that time. And a lot of the music, I suppose, was like new music at the time, so it's not even like, for me, the pieces that now are like the really famous ones and you're like, oh well, that's an amazing piece. You know, maybe at the time they weren't even the ones that were the most popular. Maybe it's the ones that have kind of been completely lost that were the most popular and everyone absolutely loved. It's funny to think that we can't really tell like 100% what people even really liked back then.
Oh!
Rachel Redmond there, and the reporter was Niamh Daly. And Rachel Baptiste, Ireland's Black Siren, is on Friday, July 19th in the Hibernia Conference Hall at Dublin Castle. Full details from dublinhandlefest.com. And before our final piece this week, can I draw your attention to a live event next week at the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Kilmainham in Dublin. We'll be recording a culture file debate in the context of the museum's Take a Breath exhibition, with myself and the panel exploring breath in art, in sport, in life. That's at 5:30 at IMA next Thursday, July 18th. Tickets are free, but you need to reserve via Eventbrite. See our social media or visit imma.ie for details. And finally, what is the sound of a bell that isn't there? Tygo Sullivan's journey into the mystic continues with the filmmaker and recordist chasing down bells of all sorts, inspired by a small detail in an old guidebook. This is Tygo Sullivan's Cloud of Unknowing.
The Shell Guide to Ireland was first published in 1962. A hefty hardback of some 500 pages, the guide is a national directory of sorts, pitched at the curious traveller in the new age of the motor tourist.
In the Emerald Isle, you drive with a smile, nothing but fun on Shell, Shell, Shell.
The Irish edition begins in Abbey, County Galway, and ends in Youghal, County Cork. In between, it has entries for almost every city, town and village in Ireland, north and south. Written by Michael Deignan and Michael Morris, a.k.a. Lord Killinin. The focus is on heritage, history and archaeology, with lots of holy wells, cathedrals, church ruins and high crosses, but also beauty spots, boating and fishing. In short, things of interest to the educated gentleman with a tank of Shell petrol and some leisure time on his hands. I always loved the Shell Guide. So when the possibility arose last year of moving to a new corner of the country, one of the first things I did was to look up our prospective home to be. So small and unremarkable as to not warrant its own entry, the small village gets a few paragraphs at the end of the section on a nearby town. A ruined church, a cairn, and, squirreled away between parentheses, mention of a small bell, which we are told is preserved in the British Museum. The British Museum catalogue entry in question shows a small dome in copper alloy, adapted as a bell from a drinking cup and dating from the 12th century. It is not on display. According to the British Museum's website, there are over 1,000 bells preserved, to use Deignan and Morris's term, at the institution. When I think of these bells at the museum, I think of the various roles that bells have played in societies everywhere in the world.
A bell is a prostitute. It yells out whatever you wish. Murder, conspiracy, revolution, an execution.
I think of Peter Brown's remarkable radio documentary,
Glocken in Europa.
A bell is just matter. Copper and tin. And that is its undoing. Hermann Göring's intention. Only 10 bells are to be preserved in the whole of Germany.
I think of my own brief career as an altar boy and the strange, powerful feeling of silencing a packed church with a small gesture of my small hand. I think of the Tarkovsky film Andrei Rublev, set in medieval Russia. In the final section, a young boy, Borishka, persuades agents of the Grand Duke that he alone holds his late father's secret to bell making, that he should be taken from his plague-infested village to cast a huge new bell.
Secret, знаю. Отец секрет медика колокольный знал. Умирал, мне передал.
What follows is a profound meditation on faith, self-belief, and unknowing, to which a whole series of these essays couldn't do justice. I think of a small love poem by Marina Tsvetaeva.
Your name is five signs. A ball caught in flight. a silver bell in the mouth.
I think of a park outside Sofia, where 1976, the International Year of the Child, was marked by Bulgaria inviting the nations of the world to donate bells, to create a public space of joy and music. The bells at the British Museum too are taken from all over the world. But when I say taken, what I actually mean is taken. The British Museum is home to thousands of artifacts and objects secured from collectors, looters, thieves, middlemen, and other agents of the British Empire. In his book, The Brutish Museums, Professor Dan Hicks argues that rather than being neutral containers displaying the world's heritage for all, institutions such as the British Museum have constructed former British colonies in the global south especially, as belonging to a timeless past, a past which the museums themselves actively create. The central idea of Hicks's book is encapsulated in what he calls a kind of motto. As the border is to the nation state, so the museum is to empire. In other words, just as the border demarcates space, determining who and what is included and excluded, so the museum demarcates time, what is present and modern, and what is past and gone. Certain museums, Hicks's brutish ones, annihilate time. It strikes me that the humble bell is the opposite of both border and museum in this sense. It is an object that transcends space. Its sound cannot be contained. It unifies time, creating a shared present moment, whether in a small church, a large city, or across a rural landscape. So to place a bell in a museum, tongue-tied, seems particularly wrong. I write to the British Museum, hoping to find out more about our local artifact. I get a very friendly reply within hours, happy to help, wondering what it is I would like to know. I write gratefully that I wish to learn about the bell, its provenance, how it ended up where it is, a general journalistic inquiry. In spite of periodic prompts and reminders, phone calls and texts over the following weeks, I hear nothing more. Perhaps the museum is afraid I will ask for the bell back. They get a lot of people asking for things back lately. The irony is, I really only have one question. I just want to know what it sounds like. Silence.
Tygo Sullivan's Cloud of Unknowing there, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. And we'll be back with more resonant objects next week. Hopefully see some of you in Imma next Thursday for the Culture File debate. And we'll be back on the radio next Saturday tea time, 6:30 p.m. here on RTE Lyric FM.